Good evening, this is Mark Lynch, and this is Inquiry. My guest tonight is editor and writer Peter Maresca, and we're talking about the book Gross Exaggerations, the Meshuggah comic strips of Milt Gross. Peter, welcome to the show. It's a pleasure to talk to you about this book.
Well, it's great to be here.
First, I have to tell you, this is a beautiful book, structurally. It's huge format. It's the size. It's like, is this the size of the Sunday Funnies at that time? I mean, it's big, and it's
But that's actually a little bit smaller than the Sunday Funnies. The earliest books I did were the full size of the Sundays. The later ones, and as you go into the later years, a lot of the pages were that larger than that, and many were smaller than that. So I picked sort of a medium size there.
But the reproductions are incredible. They're state of the art.
Yeah, that's what I spend most of my time in, and we try and
is this the mission of Sunday Press?
Yeah, pretty much. Before that, a lot of there were a lot of different ways that people were doing reproduction. Some of them were like really bright and garish with, you know, white backgrounds and super blacks, and other people just did it just the way it came out without any restoration at all. And I felt the best look was kind of between the two.
It is. I mean, you can actually read the comics. They look great. What other titles are there on Sunday Press?
Well, you can check at the website, sundaypressbooks.com, and there are a total of, I believe we have 15 titles now. We did two volumes of Little Nemo.
Oh, I have those. I didn't realize that was you guys.
Yeah. Did a volume of Crazy Cat and a volume of Frank King's Gasoline Alley.
That's right.
Then did two volumes that covered the origins of the comic strips. That was Forgotten Fantasy and Society is Nick's. And that covered the comics from 1895 to 1915.
Those large reproductions of Winsor McCay's work, I thought was the first time I ever really, you know, everything I'd ever seen was all shrunk up weirdly.
Right, and that was the problem. This was 2005, and it was going to be the 100th anniversary of Winsor McCay's Little Nemo. And I was looking at my own collection and realized that in another 100 years, it's going to be gone. It'll just deteriorate.
That's right.
Be nowhere to people to see these things the way they were supposed to be seen. So at that time, I had known nothing about book publishing or the printing process. I was in digital entertainment.
Oh, my God.
I really felt this had to be done. So I went around to a lot of different book publishers, and everybody says, well, that's a nice idea, but you can't do it. it's too big, and you can't distribute it. But seeing as how I had no experience, I didn't know what really couldn't be done. So I says, well, you just print it, you do it. But I got a little help from people who actually knew what they were doing. Art Spiegelman was a big help in getting the process together, and his wife Francoise helped me get the printer lined up, get me credit with the printer, and then I had friends in Paris who helped me actually print and assemble the book and do the design. And that's why when you first mentioned how good the book looks, just to look at it and open it up. And that's because of the designer, Philippe Gometti, in Paris, and I've been working with him ever since I started.
And it's only, I think, when you get to appreciate these comics in this format that you can appreciate the art aspect of it, and that's especially true for Winsor McCay's Little Nemo.
Exactly.
Because, first of all, that's and for people who aren't familiar with that strip, and also Winsor McCay was one of the earliest animators. Did Gertie the Dinosaur and a bunch of other stuff. Mm-hmm. But when you look at Little Nemo, I just can't imagine what it was like to get a Sunday paper and to have that kind of visual amazement just pop out at you. It was beautiful.
Yeah, free every Sunday, and then you throw it away.
Now, Milt Gross's work is in a whole other category. And it's really funny because Mark Newgarden, in the introduction to the book, says he left behind no immortal heritage. I think that's a little harsh.
Yeah.
Because it's big thanks to your book, we can now appreciate him. Although I have to say, up until your book, I knew the name and I knew he did some strips, but I couldn't really appreciate it at all.
Right. And he really started out a whole new area, the first really, well, not the first, but certainly the first widely produced screwball comics.
And explain screwball.
Crazy for the sake of being crazy and, not trying to make any sense whatsoever. and being very exaggerated. And
big shoes, big nose.
Right. And the ideas really came out of vaudeville, the vaudeville humor, same place the Marx Brothers came out of, where it just, you know, there are no boundaries, you just go all out crazy.
There is no screwball comics today in the Sunday comics, are there?
I'm trying to think. Not really.
Not on this level. What was like the last, screwball comic?
I think the one that was straight screwball, and there might have been one a little bit later, but I'm thinking the one that was still existing was Smokey Stover, and I think that was around.
And a very similar look to that classic era of screwball comics.
Right, right.
Let's talk about Gross's life. He was born. When was he born?
He was born, oh gosh, I don't know the exact date.
Okay, but approximately. Get into the decade.
Yeah, he was born right around the turn of the century, late 1800s.
Where?
In New York.
He has that New York sensibility.
Yeah.
He was the son.
It was in the the Jewish immigrants, the Eastern European Jewish immigrants.
He was the son of a beloved cantor. He relocated to East Newark, New Jersey in 1910. And then he did a lot, and I love these biography points that go along with this. He had a series of odd jobs, including a fountain pen demonstrator. That's what I want on my resume, fountain pen demonstrator. He went to art school for 2 months.
Yep, and I think he figured it didn't teach him that all that much.
Yeah, as it says in the book, he was not encouraged.
Yeah.
But, it's interesting when you read these biographies of these comic artists at that time, people aspired to being a comic artist. That was one of those things that, people said, yeah, I want to do that.
And that was, he was really the among the first who were like that, because before that, there wasn't anything there to aspire to. The earliest people like Winsor McCay and Rudolph Dirks and people who did the Cats and Jammer Kids,
yep,
and Out Cult, who did Buster Brown and Yellow Kid, they didn't aspire to that as youngsters because there was really nothing to look at.
I was going to say there's nothing before them. So they were just doing that. But as soon as that became an established art form, although I have to believe that the general public at the time didn't think it was a reputable job to have.
No, you'd be surprised because it wasn't. This stuff was humorous and funny, but it wasn't considered silly and frivolous. It was considered pretty important early on. And these guys really made a lot of money.
I know, it's amazing to read what he did, but we'll get to that in a second. He became an office boy at Hearst's, the New York American. He did his first strip, Jack Bull, which is crudely fashioned. Mm-hmm. 1915, he was back at Hearst's organization, $30 a week office boy, which is actually, for that time period, is probably not bad.
Yeah, it's it's probably like getting $15 an hour now.
Yeah, and then he was assigned to the cartoonist Thomas A. Dorgan. What can you tell me about him?
Thomas A. Dorgan was better known as Tad. Did a lot of he was essentially a sports cartoonist, and that was a big business at the time. I mean, a big part of what the cartooning job was. Because a lot of cartoonists did that in their early years. Frank King was his first job was a lot of sports cartoons long before Gasoline Alley. Also, Rube Goldberg did a lot of sports cartoons.
Yep.
Early on. And
is that because there wasn't enough photography or good photography, so there was like sort of these courtroom artists?
It was like
they were covering the sports events.
Yeah. Yeah, and they'd actually go to the sports events, and a lot of times you couldn't capture the action and the feel,
right,
of the photograph because you certainly didn't have the high shutter speeds that are going to catch the action like they did in the 30s and 40s. So a lot of the feel of it came through the comics, and also people were used to getting information that way other than straight news because the society pages would often have cartoonists drawing things. Certainly the political cartoons, which even preceded the Sunday newspaper sections, were big. So it was always the illustrations was always a big part of getting the news, a big part of the newspaper.
Now, Tad was an idol to a generation of comic artists. He was hugely influential.
Oh, yeah. Absolutely, yeah, yeah. A lot of people, a lot of people looked up to him, including people like Frank King and other people who had worked in the sports. E.C. Sagar.
Oh, Popeye.
Sports cartoons, yeah.
Thimble Theater. That's what I read. Now, right. Milt
also a Sunday Press book.
Yeah, and a good one. Milt announces he's going to become a freelancer. Was that viable back then, that you could theoretically do it as a freelancer?
That was pretty rare at the time.
Okay.
the ones who did it didn't make a heck of a lot of money at it. The thing that you wanted to do is you wanted to get yourself a regular strip and get yourself a regular paycheck. Milt, he wasn't always satisfied just doing one thing. Even in the cartooning, he wanted to move into more writing, like writing for the movies.
Yep,
he wanted
yep.
to do animation.
And he did animation. He was hired by Bray Studios.
Yeah, yeah. He did worked with them briefly. In fact, he gave up cartooning for a while.
And he worked as a artist for animation. He
right.
had short films. I love the names of these. Professor Fuller Prunes and Izzy Abel the Detective. Oh, my God. Have you seen any of these animations?
I haven't seen any of the animated stuff that was out there, no.
But he also moonlit for the Fleischer Brothers and Out of the Inkwell.
Yeah.
So what is he?
Yeah.
He was
and,
like...
And so it's hard. I don't know that you can find out exactly which of those cartoons
yeah, right.
he worked on. But...
And Paul Terry for Fable Pictures.
And the early Terry Toons, yeah.
Yeah. So he has this tremendous animation experience. And
then,
and
then writing as well. He worked at Hal Roach Studios, and he worked with Chaplin.
Wow. I'm surprised he went back to doing comics.
I think he didn't make it big in Hollywood.
Okay.
I don't know if
that's a common enough story.
Yeah, didn't have the right temperament for it, or I'm not sure what it is, but he ended up back doing what he was greatest at, and that was the cartooning.
Now, the animation experience was also important for him for his later career, working in dailies and then the Sundays, because you had to learn to draw fast and accurately.
Right.
And if people don't realize this, the early animation was before there were cells. So you did.
Well, I think by the time he was doing it,
he's doing cells.
They were using cells. McKay didn't use cells.
No, that's all. That's.
But McKay, I think
McKay was insane.
Got into the early Fleischer cartoons and the Terry Toons. They had cells for backgrounds.
There's a great
so I solid think, backgrounds and then cells for the.
I character. Think it's in Gertie the Dinosaur by Winsor McKay. It shows him holding a huge stack of big
right.
trucks, and which he then trips over. He's fired from Bray Christmas Eve. He has a sick son, and he phones a publisher, Ralph Pulitzer. Is that the Ralph Pulitzer of the Pulitzer
yep,
Prize?
Yep, the Rudolph.
Yeah. So what does that work? Could you just call him up at that point in time and go give me a job?
And I'm not sure how that story went. If he actually just called him up directly, or if he got one of the underlings, but. Yeah, he did get in touch with the man himself. Pulitzer was one of these one of the publishers who was really very very hands-on in the area of the comics.
Now his first daily strip, 1923, is Hits and Misses.
Hits and Misses, yeah. His first regular.
HITZ and Misses.
Yeah, yeah.
It's a daily strip, and he tacked on this little extra non sequitur panel. Initially, it was called applesauce, and later it was called banana oil. Now, if there's one thing I'm going to remember about Mel Gross, it's going to be banana oil. Was that a term from that point, that era?
There were a lot of euphemisms.
Okay.
Or just bullshit.
Okay.
And banana oil was one of them, and I think that was in existence as a euphemism, but he really popularized it.
Oh, my God. I mean, there was a Tin Pan Alley song after his thing. There was a book collection. I mean,
right.
Banana oil just like took off. And the funny thing is this little addenda to his regular strip became more popular than Hits and Misses.
Yeah. And that then became its own daily strip. And it became a topper strip to his Nice Baby.
How would you describe banana oil before we move on to Nice Baby?
Yeah, well, banana oil was a lot of what he did was social satire.
Okay.
So he would like to point out all of the hypocrisies of life and the inconsistencies that went on, and so banana oil gave a little bit of a slice of life where people would claim something was going on, think something was going to happen, and in reality, it didn't.
It was all banana oil.
It was all just banana oil.
And that had a feature in every strip, didn't it? The title,
yeah,
banana,
yeah,
oil.
The last panel was banana oil.
Now, his sensibilities really crystallize in this strip. And then he starts to work for the New York World. And I love the writing about this. It describes, it really embodied the jazz age aesthetic at that time. And when you realize the people who were writing for it, H.L. Mencken and Dorothy Parker. And Gross was part of that. He was part of that whole sort of wild world. It's sort of, you sort of can't imagine that.
Mm. Yeah, that was the New York scene. And at the same time, they had a similar scene in Chicago with Ringlardner Jr. And the comic artists who worked at the Chicago Tribune would go hang out and have drinks and lunches with Ringlardner, and then they'd swap jokes.
Wow. We have nothing to approximate that nowadays.
No.
It's like...
Well, for one thing, the comic artists don't go to the office like they used to.
That's right, especially in the last year.
Yeah.
But they didn't before that either. I mean, people should realize that sort of ended a while ago. You can do everything and get
it
mailed
sure
in.
Exactly when it ended, certainly in the war years, World War II, wasn't happening the same way. But all through the 20s and 30s, for the most part, these guys would go down to the office and they'd hang out with each other while they were sitting at their drawing tables.
Now comes Gross Exaggerations and Nice Baby, N-I-Z-E, Baby. Talk to me about that strip, because that's what I think, if people are going to remember him about one strip, it's going to be Nice Baby.
Right. And that's the one that really, where he really got into his own style, his screwball style. And this one in particular came out of the Jewish vaudeville comedian.
Yeah,
because of the Yiddish American, the Yiddish English dialect.
And looking and reading those strips is funny. It's one of those things where you actually, as a reader, contemporary reader, you actually find yourself reading it out loud so that it makes sense.
You
have to, because it's done in that Yiddish dialect. That's absolutely amazing.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yeah, it almost doesn't make sense unless you read it out loud, or think it really loud in your head.
There's Smack, the South Bronx theory of child. Now, it's an amazing strip. It's popular. It's collected in a book. And then he writes...
There were a couple of books. There was music.
And he also writes other things. He wrote a book called Hiawatha Witnawada Poems, O-D-D-E-R.
Yeah, his whole series of books in the Yiddish dialect.
Now, it became a Milton...
And that went from the 20s right on through the 50s.
Wow. Now, in February 1929, Nice Baby, the Sunday feature, is replaced by another one of his strips, Count Screwloose of Toulouse.
Right.
Now, what's the basic premise of that?
And here again, it's a satire, a social satire, and it's sort of the fish out of water, the stranger in the strange land, and there's a guy who's in an institution. And he wants to escape and get back to the real world. And every time he goes out into the real world, he experiences things that are crazier than they were in the crazy asylum. So he always ends up getting back in. It's kind of like a reverse Little Nemo where he starts out into the fantasy world and then goes into this real world, which is so crazy that he ends up going back.
And there's the catchphrase, Iggy, keep an eye on me.
Keep an eye on me.
And this was the classic. This was the era of the sort of really screwy cartoons and comics, the Bigfoot era of American funnies, anything for a laugh. And as people have described it, he drew funny. You look at these strips in this book, and I defy you to keep a straight face.
Yeah. Even without reading them,
They just look funny, but they read really wild. Now he did a bunch of other things. He wrote another book called "He Done a Wrong," the great American novel, and not a word in it. No music too.
Yeah, that was it was considered by many to be the first really popular modern graphic novel, and it's done all without words.
He moves to L.A., which is a big move. That's a weird move. He acquires the estate of Douglas Fairbanks Jr. and Joan Crawford, and he starts screenwriting.
Yeah.
And he's there with people like Charlie Chaplin.
Mm-hmm.
And then, as it says in the book, he worked his way down from that. And there's so many weird asides in the background writing of this book. Hitler.
Yeah, Mark did a great job. Well, Mark has been working on this for probably 5 or 6 years, even before this book came out.
Well,
doing all of the research.
Apparently, Hitler burned a copy of Nye's Baby in Vienna.
Huh.
So you know your book is good. If Hitler Hitler burns your book, you've got it made. But then this weird thing happens to him. He gets serious about painting, and in this book there's some reproductions of his serious painting. He wanted to be one of the California regionalists, which is an art movement that most people aren't familiar with unless you're from California.
Right.
He did magazine comics for life. He did one pagers. And then in 1945, he had a heart attack. He was a workaholic. He got involved in early television too. And later in his life, he was just totally disillusioned. And he died November 29th, 1953.
Yeah. Died on a cruise ship coming back from Hawaii.
Yeah. Yeah. Now, the only book that's done in dialect, the only strip that's done in dialect is Nye's Baby.
Right. And I'm not sure exactly why, but I think it didn't fit when he moved on to other strips. It fit here because this was about, all the characters were a single family. And the family was living in like Lower East Side tenements, and
it's the Feitelbaum family.
Yeah.
Jewish mother and father, and three sons: Logie Dope, Dot Dope, Isidore, and Nye's Baby, Ignatz.
Louis de Dope.
Louis de Dope. Right. I have to say it out loud. It didn't make any sense while I was really Louis Dot Dope, Isidore, and Nye's Baby, who was Ignatz.
Right.
Wow. What an amazing comic. I mean, do you think from publishing this book that his contribution to the medium will be reevaluated? Because it wasn't. You know, you read a little bit about him, but you just never read a lot about him.
Yeah.
Now,
I would hope it would catch on, you know, to pull like Little Nemo really pulled the strip out of the comics ghetto, and people who were not necessarily interested in comics got to see how worthwhile it was.
But the screwball comics are definitely a different kind of sell. I mean, the thing with Little Nemo is you have to be really visually ignorant to not love those big sweeping panels, you know, those huge, long, narrow panels that often appear. They're just gorgeous. But this stuff is definitely a whole other thing. This is like going from, you know, something by Shakespeare into something by the Three Stooges. And you have to be up for it. I mean, there's a time and a place for that. I mean, it's definitely, I think it's pretty amazing.
Mm-hmm. Well, they came from two different places. You know, the stuff in Windsor McKay and a lot of the early things, the early comic strips. Well, the early comic strips really came out from two roots. One was the editorial cartoons, where you got a lot of the social and political comics in the early days, like Yellow Kid, and things like Little Nemo and the Kinder Kids. They really came from the emerging illustrated children's books, and that was something new in the 1890s and early 1900s. And that's where Little Nemo came from. And Nye's Baby, on the other hand, came out of Jewish vaudeville,
and it also came out of the immigrant experience in New York.
Yes.
And in that sense, that strip alone is worth its weight in gold. It's really part of what the sensibility was of that time. Mm-hmm. Is that part of the mission for what you're doing with the press?
I guess the big thing for me is so that not only do people get a chance to read these, but they get a chance to experience them in the way that people experienced them when they were new. So that's why they have the sort of soft color look, the type of paper that feels like thick newsprint, although it's going to last a lot longer.
That's always
and,
nice.
And it doesn't have the garish colors that you'd find in a brand new book.
Can I talk to you about original sources that you needed to reprint these? Yeah. Were those incredibly difficult to find?
Most of them came out of my own collection, and I've got a network of different collectors and libraries and so forth where I could find things where I'll need to fill in the gaps.
I got to ask you about that then. When did you start collecting comics like that? So you're talking about actually the original pages of the Sunday Press, right?
Right.
How did you even get started that?
In the early 70s, I was working as a land surveyor in the Hudson Valley in New York.
Okay, and so I don't see this career change coming.
So then,
what pushed you over the edge?
Somebody said, "Oh, there's a guy." At the time, I was reading Marvel Comics, most 20-year-olds.
Yep.
And I said, "Oh, this old guy, he's got to move out of his house, and he's got a lot of comics he needs to get rid of." I said, "Oh, great, maybe I'll find some Marvels or some early age." So I go to the place, and the guy's just got stacks of newspaper comics. And turned out, since he was 5 years old, which would have been mid-20s, he had been given all of the Sunday newspapers. His father went and bought them at the store, all of the New York Sunday newspapers. At the time, that was four or five different newspapers.
And he collected
newspapers.
Them?
And he would pull out the Sunday comics and stack them in the attic.
Oh, my God.
He had them all there.
Oh, my God.
And I spent 3 or 4 hours, it was probably half a day, with the guy as he started going through them. And he would pull one out and say, "Oh, yeah, well, this is where Tarzan was doing this and this." And they weren't even in any order, but he knew every story of every comic.
Wow.
And had been reading them and rereading them for 50 years, 60 years.
Wow. First of all, Peter, that's a great story. And now I totally get how you could have gotten into that. I would have loved that.
Yeah, and then I'm looking at the – I says, This is amazing. I had never seen Flash Gordon before.
Oh, yeah, the original Flash Gordon and Tarzan.
Nemo.
Yeah.
And so the first time I saw all of this stuff was in the size of a newspaper, which is probably 20% bigger than a full-page newspaper is now.
We're completely out of time, Peter. That was a great story.
Oh, that was fun.
It was. My guest tonight has been editor, writer Peter Maresca, and we've been talking about the book Gross Exaggerations, the Meshuggah Comic Strips of Milt Gross. It's a great book, really different. Peter, thank you so much for your time.
My pleasure. A lot of fun. Thanks.
You're listening to WICN 90.5 FM. This is Inquiry. My name is Mark Lynch. Good night.